Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Bruce McCullough and I represent the appellants in this case, Henry Rolfe and Edgar Mitchell. The argument this afternoon is going to be presented by David Perlman, who's been admitted to the bar of this court, pro hac vice.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
When I start the clock, there'll be a green light and it'll go down to a yellow light. The yellow light means you're into the time you've reserved. You can continue, but you know you will be using your reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. What is at stake in this case is nothing less than the survival of the common law standard of fiduciary duty as it applies to a trustee in Delaware. Mellon Trust engaged in a conflict of interest that was in breach of a trust. Consequently, it should not be permitted to foreclose on the trust assets over which it served as trustee. I will argue 3 points. First, that the fiduciary duty standard applies. Secondly, that Mellon Trust breached its fiduciary duty. And thirdly, that the beneficiaries did not consent to the breach. Subject to any questions the court may have, I would like to rely on my briefs for the argument that the fiduciary duty issue is preserved, and for the argument that Mellon violated a good faith standard should a good faith standard apply. First, the fiduciary duty standard applies in this case. While it is true that a trust document can alter or modify the underlying prevailing common law fiduciary.
Was there a concession before the Court of Chancery that the test was good faith?
The record transcript before the Chancery judge did reflect a concession by the attorney that the good faith standard applied. However, a little bit later in this in the same transcript on page 38, he raised the fiduciary duty issue again. And I would submit that that concession doesn't, not only was it contradicted later in the transcript, but it doesn't bind this court to instituting or cementing into law the error of the Chancery Court if the good faith standard does not apply. It's really an error of law. Applying the good faith standard is really an error of law, and this court has the power to correct the error of law of the Chancery Court. Moreover, I think it was the issue has been preserved, amply preserved in the pleadings, and moreover, the Chancery Court's final order actually discusses good faith and discusses a fiduciary duty and enters a finding on fiduciary duty. So I don't think this court's bound by the concession that does appear in the record at one point in the record by the attorney before the Chancery Court.
But do you agree or disagree that the terms of the trust, either expressly or by implication, allowed transactions that would otherwise be a breach of loyalty, the duty of loyalty?
They do allow a transaction that would otherwise be a breach of fiduciary duty, specifically a transaction where the trustee loans money to the trust and takes a pledge of assets from the trust. It does, and that would be a conflict of interest, and it is permitted under Article 4, Section C of the trust document. And that's precisely what Mellon Trust relies on in this case. But the problem is that's not the transaction that occurred in this case. What occurred in this case was a loan to the beneficiaries, which is not permitted under the trust, and then a pledge of assets of the trust for a loan to the beneficiaries. That's not permitted under the trust. And so I don't think that Mellon, what the good faith standard is, let me backtrack for a minute. The good faith standard is established by Article 6, Section C of the trust document. And essentially that says where the trustee exercises its discretion under the trust document, a good faith standard shall apply to its actions. The problem is that the transaction in this case was not an exercise of discretion under the trust document because it was not permitted by Article 4, Section C, which is the one Mellon Trust relies on and which allows for a loan to the trust, not a loan to the beneficiaries. And moreover, Article 4, Section M, which Mellon Trust also relies on, doesn't save Mellon, because Article 4, Section M allows for a pledge of trust assets in exchange for a loan, but it only allows for a pledge of trust assets in exchange for a loan provided for under Article 4, and the only loan provided for under Article 4 is a loan to the trust and not a loan to the beneficiaries.
To what extent is the history and the circumstances of loans and relevant to these interpretations?
I think the background that there was a trust, that his mother had a trust, and that there was a loan before that, I don't think it's really relevant to interpreting and applying the fiduciary duty standard to the critical facts of this case. It's background information, but it's not dispositive in any way. My second point is that I think it's clear that Mellon Trust breached its fiduciary duty. This was essentially admitted by the two key Mellon employees, first Susan Gruber, the loan officer, and Greg Landis, both in their depositions admitted that the bank, as an interested lender, participated in trust management and investment decisions. And this became particularly clear, and the facts are undisputed, in September 2008, when the market crashed. On September 11th, 2008, when the account was under margin by a mere $8,000, Susan Gruber, the loan officer on the case, took control of the trust, and by email she directed what should be bought and sold in the trust, and she said in the same email that if the market drops, something more will have to be done, and she demanded that nothing was to leave the account. This is the loan officer directing how the trust should be disposed, strictly to satisfy the loan requirements and the lending needs of Mellon Bank. Indeed, the market did drop, because on September 26, 2008, she had a phone conversation with her colleagues, which she followed up with an email, and the email begins with an all cap demand that no distributions are to be made from the trust. She also said, "I just want to make sure that my loan is adequately secured." And she said that she wanted to be sure that nothing happens into the account without keeping me involved. This is the loan officer. Finally, she revealed in the same email what her ultimate plan was, which was to liquidate the trust to pay off the loan, leaving Rolf with whatever remained in the trust. And she attempted to accomplish this goal shortly thereafter. On October 7th, 2008, she had a phone conversation with Rolf and Mitchell, where she sought their agreement to liquidate the trust to pay off the loan. And Henry Rolf would not agree. He wanted to sell a house he had in Maine to pay down the loan.
So, well, I'm getting a little confused here. I thought that the loan was secured by the trust's assets, wasn't it?
Yes, it was secured by the trust assets.
Well, doesn't that normally mean that if the loan is not being repaid, that the trust assets can be used to satisfy the loan?
Yes, it does, and that's exactly the problem in this case, is that we have the fiduciary, the trustee, acting as if it's a lender without regard to the interests of the beneficiaries. It's taking on the role of a lender, and in that respect it's breaching its fiduciary duty, because it's on the wrong side of the conflict of interest. It's no longer looking out for the borrower's interests, but it's looking, or the beneficiary's interests, but it's looking out for its own interests as a lender.
How were your clients going to be able to pay off the loan?
Well, that's not really an issue before the court or before the Chancery Court. The point of the petition the point of the petition, the relief sought in the petition, was permission for the fiduciary to hand over the trust to the lending arm of Mellon Bank. And the counter petition sought to remove the trustee as the trustee. So how they're going to pay off the loan is a problem that's not really before this court.
Well, but isn't that what underlies the problem here?
Well, that generated the relationship, the lending relationship, but it's not for this court to answer how the loan will be paid off. As a matter of fact, the loan documents call for exclusive jurisdiction in the United States District Court of Massachusetts and the application of Massachusetts law. So this court is...
BNY Mellon wanted authority to be able to use the trust assets to satisfy the loan, right?
Yes.
And the court gave it the authority, correct?
Yes.
And if your clients were of the view that this is not appropriate because your clients were in a position to satisfy this loan without reaching this security, wouldn't your clients have brought that up?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really explored that with my clients. I mean, they want to preserve the trust for reasons that are not really part of the record in this case. And
what I'm trying to get at, and I may be going off in the wrong direction here, but it seems to me that if there is a loan that is secured by trust assets and the loan needs to be repaid, and the beneficiaries of the trust say, oh, we don't want you to use the trust assets to repay this loan, they would be offering some other alternative, because from the bank's perspective and the trust's perspective, that's all there is, a loan and trust assets. If there's a third component that would resolve the situation, wouldn't that have been the time for it to be raised so that the court could then, the trial court here could then consider whether the petition should be granted or not?
I think that the petition, that would have been a way to resolve the entire dispute, would be to pay off the loan from another source. And what the beneficiaries wanted to do was to sell real estate after it had appreciated to pay off the loan. But that's not the direction, that's not the way history played itself out. And the fact that history played itself out in a different way, and they didn't offer alternative form of payment in the past or before the Chancery Court, doesn't impact the fiduciary duty issue in this case. If there's a breach of fiduciary duty, Mellon is not entitled to foreclose on the trust assets.
So let me put it a different way. What was the trustee supposed to do when the loan is called and the trust assets are the security for the loan? What is the trustee supposed to do other than petition the court and say, we're being told we have to pay this off, is it all right?
Right. Well, actually, the trustee, I'm not saying they were wrong to petition the court. I'm saying they're not entitled to the relief that they sought. If I were to go back even further in history, I would argue that the trustee never should have entered this transaction to begin with. It never should have loaned money to the beneficiaries, and as the trustee pledged assets to its affiliate to secure a loan to the beneficiaries, because it wasn't permitted by the trust document, and it raised ultimately what would be an irresolvable, as time played out, an irresolvable conflict of interest. It's a conflict that I don't even think the beneficiaries could consent to.
And did the Court of Chancery address that issue you just raised, that it wasn't permitted by the trust instrument?
The Court of Chancery the Court of Chancery did not address that issue directly. It answered it by saying that this was a good faith standard applied. And it exercised its good faith by following its what it was entitled to do under the loan documents. That's the way it answered the question, but I don't think that was a proper way of answering the question for two reasons, because the good faith standard doesn't apply, and simply because a Mellon affiliate is following what's permitted under the loan documents doesn't mean Mellon is honoring its fiduciary duty. In fact, if it's just pursuing its own self-interest under the loan documents, it would be breaching its fiduciary duty.
So, as I understand your position, even under the sprinkled terms, this type of transaction was not permitted. Is that correct?
Yes. The sprinkle provision permits a pledge of trust assets for Henry Rolfe's benefit, but it does not contemplate the conflict of interest that occurred in this case, and it does not grant the trustee the power to extend a loan to the beneficiaries. a trustee.
Well, let's take those three concepts one at a time so I can understand them. First, does the sprinkle provision in the document permit this absent a conflict of interest? Let's suppose the loan would have been to M&T Bank. Henry came in and said, look, right, I'm borrowing money from M&T Bank. I want to pledge the trust assets as security.
Yeah, it would permit a pledge of trust assets to a non-affiliate bank, M&T Bank.
All right. Yes. So the first point is it would be permitted. Your problem here is that it was a conflicted transaction.
Yes.
And your ultimate position is, notwithstanding the provisions in the agreement that say the conflict could occur, that it was impermissible for the document to provide for conflicted transactions at all?
No, I'm not saying that it's impermissible to provide for conflicted transactions at all. I'm saying that it did not provide for this particular conflicted transaction.
Okay, so can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. The key trust provision that Mellon relies on is 4C, which says it grants, it's part of the general administrative provisions of the trust that permit a trustee to basically operate a trust. And 4C says the trustee can borrow money even if it's a lender and pledge assets for such a loan. So when it says a trustee can borrow even if it's the lender, it's only granting the trustee the power to be a lender when it's also a borrower. So that would be a loan from the trustee to the trust, and then a pledge of assets in exchange for that loan. And although it's not elaborated on in the trust, it makes some sense, because in exchange for the value of the pledge, the trust is receiving the loan proceeds. And thereafter, they could only leave the trust under some other provision of the trust.
Well, that's where I got confused before, and maybe you can help me out of this, because what you're saying is, notwithstanding all of those provisions, if we go back to the sprinkle terminology, this transaction would have been permitted with M&T or any other bank, but it wasn't permitted here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and why is everything that you just told us relevant about the earlier provision in the trust? How did it make it? Why wasn't this permissible? If it's okay with M&T, then we substitute Mellon. Why does it become impermissible?
Because this is a conflict of interest, and it's not one contemplated by the trust. And moreover, it's not one that's rescued by Section 16G of the trust document, which is, although is entitled conflicts of interest, doesn't relieve Mellon or the trustee for the type of conflict that occurred in this case. Section 16G applies to the situation where the trustee is using a banking affiliate to execute brokerage transactions when it's managing the trust assets, and permits the trustee to pay its banking affiliate commissions under that provision, commissions for those transactions. And it's clear that it applies to that limited circumstance because of the repetition of the word services in connection with brokerage services. And the second sentence, which begins specifically and then deals specifically with the brokerage relationship. And finally, it is clear that it applies to that situation because the last sentence of that paragraph says it confers the power on the beneficiaries to cancel the powers conferred by that section. And it would make no sense if the beneficiaries could cancel the power of Mellon Bank to lend money in a conflicted situation, because as soon as they canceled that power, they would render Mellon liable for the conflict. However, it does make sense to cancel a power to enter brokerage transactions.
Do you want to save the time yet remaining?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Chad Shamler of Richards, Latham & Finger on behalf of petitioner below, BNY Mellon Trust of Delaware. I'm joined at council table by Don Sparks and Allison Camara. There are three main points that I would like to discuss today, the first of which is Section 3303 of Title 12 of the Delaware Code and its importance in interpreting trust, the trust. The second are the terms of the trust instrument itself, which on its face permits the loan transaction contemplated by the complained of by the appellants. And the third are the facts and circumstances surrounding the creation of the trust, which support the court below's finding that BNY Mellon Trust did not breach its fiduciary duty. Before I address those points, I'd like to briefly touch on the corporate affiliations here, as I think they've been jumbled a little bit. BNY Mellon Trust of Delaware, the co-trustee in this matter, administers trusts in Delaware. It does not make investments, nor does it provide loans. BNY Mellon N.A. Is a separate entity, and like BNY Mellon Trust of Delaware, it is a subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation. So while BNY Mellon N.A. and BNY Mellon Trust are affiliated, they are separate legal entities with different functions. I mention this because the trustee, BNY Mellon Trust, did not provide the loans in this case, of course. BNY Mellon N.A. was the lender, and therefore the facts of this case, I think, differentiate this from the traditional self-dealing cases cited by appellants in their briefs, and therefore it brings into play specific rules regarding transactions with affiliates of trustees, most of which, granted, do not apply here. However, the one rule that does apply here that differentiates our position from theirs is the fact that the extent to which the trust instrument controls the fiduciary duties of BNY Mellon Trust. Appellants would like this court to disregard the trust instrument and base its decision solely on fiduciary principles. However, as correctly determined by the court below, Section 3303 of Title 12 governs the actions of the trustees in this matter. Under Section 3303, the court is instructed to give maximum effect to the freedom of disposition and to the enforceability of governing instruments. Thus, notwithstanding any common law principles, the terms of the trust instrument at issue here delineates the powers, duties, and fiduciary responsibilities of BNY Mellon Trust. And in this case, the trust instrument is very broad. It permits the trustees to delegate certain functions to affiliates of BNY Mellon Trust. It permits them to distribute assets to the beneficiary at their sole discretion. It permits the trustees to pledge assets for the benefit of the beneficiary, and it permits them to borrow money from anybody, including the lender, the trustee itself, or affiliates of the trustee. And importantly, as determined by the court below,
the pledging of assets.
Yes.
As I understand, the other side's position is that this particular transaction is not contemplated by Article 4 because the language, "I authorize my trustee to pledge assets as collateral or as security for any amounts borrowed pursuant to this Article 4, so that if it doesn't fit that niche, then we're back into common law fiduciary duty.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that's your argument, and
well, why is that wrong?
We don't agree with it for several reasons. The first of which, the trust instrument does not limit loans to the trust itself. It's not so limiting. There's no language they can point to in the trust instrument that says you can loan to the trust, but you can't loan to the beneficiary of the trust. There's simply no language there. And moreover, if the court reads the trust document as a whole, rather than the one specific provision in isolation, as the appellants are wont to do, it is rather obvious that the trust instrument is intended to cover loans assets pledged to the loans for the beneficiary himself. The starting point for this analysis is the sprinkle trust provision, the dispositive provision of the trust, which at page A78 of the appendix provides the trustees with the discretion to distribute, and more significantly in this case, to pledge for Mr. Robb's benefit as much of the trust income and principal as necessary. Thus, the dispositive provision allows the trustees to pledge assets for the benefit of the beneficiary, which is exactly what BNY Mellon Trust did here. Section 4C of the trust agreement, of course, provides the trustee with the authority to borrow from anyone, even the lender. And Section 4M, also on page A83 of the appendix, provides the trustees may pledge assets as collateral for any amounts borrowed. So with these two provisions of Section 4, read in conjunction with the dispositive provision of the trust, it only makes sense that the trustee would be permitted to pledge assets to cover a loan made to the beneficiary. Otherwise, the sprinkle trust provision would be read to be superfluous and would really have little meaning and be inconsistent with the remainder of the trust. So we think, based on the reading of the document as a whole, the transaction that is challenged here was certainly permissible.
But the argument we're hearing is that may be true generally, but when the loan relates or comes from an affiliate, then we have a specific problem and generated by the conflict.
I think that's covered by the trust instrument, Your Honor. That's part of the delegation of authority in this case under the trust, and it is also covered by Section 4 and Section 4C and Section 4M, which permits the lender to be anybody, even the trustee. It doesn't say it is only the trustee. It could be the trustee. It could be an affiliate of the trustee. It could be M&T Bank. It could be Wilmington Trust. It could be virtually anybody. It's all covered within the trust instrument itself.
In which section is that?
That's Section 4C of the trust, which is on page of the appendix. If you give me one moment. A83 of the appendix, Section 4C. Section 4M is also on that page, which deals with the pledge of assets. So relying on the provisions of the trust instrument itself and giving the instrument the deference to which it is entitled under Section 3303, the Court of Chancery properly concluded that the trust instrument allowed Mellon to engage in the transaction, which it did, as long as Mellon exercised its discretion under the trust in good faith. And
can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
Section 4M, trustees authorized to pledge assets as collateral or security for any amount borrowed pursuant to Article 4. Your opponents say that this money was not borrowed by the trust. It was borrowed by the beneficiaries. And the assets were pledged by the trust, but the trust didn't receive the loan. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because
why not?
Under the terms of the instrument, it is not limited to loans to the beneficiary. The trust. The beneficiary may receive loans under this trust document. The corpus of the trust, it was pledged as the collateral, which I think is what is contemplated under Section 4M.
All right. Well, again, I'm just focusing on the word borrowed. Did the trust borrow anything?
The trust itself did not borrow anything, but it the corpus of the trust was used as collateral to secure the loan.
So what provision are you relying on to pledge the corpus of the trust as collateral?
We're relying on the trust document as a whole and not just one specific provision. I think, as I said earlier, the document as a whole, when read in its entirety.
In the penumbra of the document?
Yes.
Can you help us with any specifics, you know, that might get us there?
Well, as I said earlier, the corpus of the trust was pledged as the collateral. So while the beneficiary was the borrower, the collateral which secured the loan and allowed the beneficiary to borrow the assets was the corpus of the trust.
Okay, but I understand it's a triangular situation.
Right.
And arguably the trust agreement could have said, the trust assets can be used to pledge as pledge or collateral for any loan to the trust or its beneficiaries.
Right.
Doesn't say that.
It does not.
Okay. And instead it says it can be used, the assets can be pledged as collateral for any amounts borrowed. Now, under what broad definition of borrowed do you say that the trust borrowed anything from BNY Mellon N.A.?
And as a technical matter, it did not. But
okay, so don't we have to worry about technical matters like the trust says?
Well, I think if you look at the document as a whole, as I said numerous times, it gets you there. And also think you need to look at the facts and circumstances surrounding the execution of the trust to see what was really happening here. And if I may touch on that for a moment. I think it would shed some light on this issue. In this case, the facts show that the appellants were both very sophisticated individuals, well-educated men with a long history and experience in the banking industry. They had a history of taking loans and using those loans to secure extensive home renovations. And one of these prior loans was with BNY Mellon Trust. With BNY Mellon N.A., the trust, but N.A., in which Mr. Rolfe, in his capacity as trustee of his mother's trust, pledged assets to secure a loan for his personal benefit.
Well, did I read the record correctly that one of the purposes of this trust was to protect Mr. Rolfe against himself?
That was the intended purpose, but it certainly didn't turn out that way, because instead of paying off the loan that he took out with assets from his mother's trust when his mother passed away, he carried that loan forward, set up the asset protection trust, then quickly used that trust to secure an additional loan to pay for additional home renovations. And the loan documentation was drawn up. Mr. Rolfe signed the loan documents, including the affidavit of trustees and the demand note, which made clear that the trustees not only were permitted to pledge the assets of the trust to secure the loan for Rolfe, but that Mr. Rolfe specifically authorized the trustees to make the pledge.
Now, the other side says that this history is not relevant, that we ought to just look at the terms of the document.
I think that's contrary to Delaware law, which allows the court to look at the facts and circumstances surrounding the creation of a trust to help interpret the trust instrument.
When it is ambiguous?
Not when it's ambiguous. That's the general rule as set forth in the Chavin case, that the court may do that to help form the intent of the instrument.
Well, in your recitation of the facts a moment ago, you said it didn't turn out to be a protection for him against himself, but it only turned out not to be a protection if the trust could pledge the trust assets for his loan. Isn't that correct?
It is correct, but it was not made without informed consent. He had a personal attorney, Mr. Sweeney, who was also a co-trustee of the trust, who explained to him that the attorney recommended that he not make the pledge or make the loan. He disregarded the attorney's advice, went forward, and it was explained to him when he was engaging in this transaction that he was waiving any conflict of interest with respect to Mellon Bank. Importantly, I was getting to the affidavit of trustees, which states that the trustees warrant and represent that the loan to Rolfe and the grant of security interest in the collateral is within the power and authority of the trustees and the stated purposes of the trust. So the affidavit of trustees, which Rolfe signed, said that this loan was within the stated purposes of the trust. That appears on paragraph 3 of page A1 of 102 of the affidavit of trustees. Moreover, the demand note, which Mr. Rolfe testified that he read and understood, and particularly understood that the loan was payable on demand, identifies the lender as BNY Mellon N.A., the affiliate of the trustee.
This sounds a little bit like an estoppel argument, that basically you're demonstrating to the court that the appellants knew what they were doing to the extent that the actual provisions of the trust might not technically authorize this transaction. They knew that. They agreed to it. They benefited from it. And at this point, they're stopped from saying, oh, no, you weren't allowed to pledge these assets that I asked you to pledge.
It is a form of estoppel argument, Your Honor, whether you want to call it estoppel, ratification, acquiescence. We raise those arguments below. And significantly, the court need not rely on common law principles or those common law doctrines. It can look to Section 3588 of Title 12 of the Delaware Code, which specifically states that a beneficiary may not hold a trustee liable for breach of trust if the beneficiary, while having capacity, consented to or ratified the transaction constituting the alleged breach. That's paraphrasing it, but that's essentially what 3588 says. So whether or not, let's suppose for a moment the trust instrument does not contemplate the transaction at issue here, which we disagree with, the actions of the borrower, of the beneficiary, certainly ratified what was done. They didn't complain about any alleged conflict of interest when they were receiving the proceeds in 2005 2006, 2007, and 2008, drawing upon the money, using it for home renovations. Nothing at all was mentioned about a conflict of interest until the lender called the note, and then shortly thereafter, the demand letters were sent.
Did the Court of Chancery address that 3588 argument?
It did not, Your Honor. We raised it in our briefs below, but it was not a basis on which the court based its decision, because the court below relied strictly on 3303 and the terms of the trust instrument. But it was raised below. We also raised 3586 of Title 12, which allows a trustee to rely on good faith on the terms of the instrument itself, which also is part and parcel of the same estoppel argument.
You seem to agree that if we look at the terms of the trust instrument literally, we may not find the specific authorization, but if we look at the terms of the trust as a whole, it's implied.
I think if you, yes, Your Honor, if you look at the terms.
When you say the Court of Chancery based its decision on the terms of the trust, what did it rely on?
The Court of Chancery relied on the sprinkle provision. It relied on the Section 4C, Section 4M, and the conflict of interest provision in the trust, which appears later on in the trust at Section Article 16, Paragraph G, where it says it shall not be deemed a conflict of interest if my corporate trustee or its affiliate has an interest in mutual funds, brokerage services, lending activities, or in any other respect of the banking or investment business.
But you're telling us today.
So the Court of, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but the Court of Trustee relied on all of those provisions to formulate its decision.
But you're not arguing today that any of those provisions literally authorize what happened here.
I think the sprinkle provision does literally allow the trustee to pledge trust assets for the benefit of the beneficiary. And it does not say that loans cannot be made to the borrower under that provision or anywhere else in the trust. So if you're going to pin me down, I would say if the one specific provision the court can rely upon to say that the loan transaction here was permitted by the terms of the trust instrument, I would rely on that provision in conjunction then with the fact that nothing in the trust instrument itself said that the lender could not be the trustee or an affiliate of the trustee. In fact, if you look at Section 4C, the document itself contemplates that the trustee may in fact be a lender, and its affiliate may be a lender.
Now, that good faith fiduciary standard applies to the sprinkle provision as well?
It applies to the entire trust to the extent that the trustee had discretion to exercise its fiduciary powers.
So
that's a yes.
So if we just focus on the sprinkle provision, then you tie that to the affidavit in your argument by saying the sprinkle provision could be read as authorizing this transaction. And in the affidavit, the trustee and the beneficiary both agree this was an authorized transaction.
Yes, the affidavit of trustees, which the beneficiary signed, specifically states that this transaction is permissible under the trust and it is within the scope of the trust.
And I, to the extent we hear the argument that Mitchell didn't sign, I understand your response to be that they were jointly and severally liable on the loan, and to the extent the trust was pledged for the benefit of one, it was pledged for the benefit of all, so the absence of Mitchell's signature really isn't a problem.
Correct. And Mitchell is a beneficiary, it becomes a beneficiary upon the passing of Mr. Rolfe. So at the time, the true beneficiary of the trust, at least the lifetime beneficiary, was Mr. Rolfe. I have nothing further unless Your Honors have any questions. Thank you.
Real quickly, why aren't you stopped from making these arguments?
Because this is the trustee is required to obtain the consent of the beneficiaries after full disclosure. That's what the Stegmaier case says. And I don't think that they obtained the kind of consent that was necessary for the conflict of interest that is merely in the penumbras of a trust document. This is a unique transaction because the conflict of interest did not begin and end with a single transaction or a unique case. On the one hand, Mellon was a trustee owing obligations to the beneficiaries, and on the other hand, over a period of years, it was also a lender, or its affiliate was a lender. There was no way, consequently, the mere knowledge that the beneficiaries had that the loan was outstanding and that they had pledged assets doesn't solve the problem, because they never would really know when will the rights of the lender trump the obligations of fiduciary during the period of time.
They signed an affidavit of consent.
Well, then, if that allows the lender to the fiduciary to become a lender, that essentially destroys the fiduciary duty to begin with. Then the fiduciary is no longer a fiduciary.
No, you're not understanding. Okay. They signed an affidavit of consent. Having signed that, or at least one of them having signed that, doesn't that serve as an estoppel?
Well, it wasn't really a consent. It was a document thrust in front of them that said that the trustee.
So they didn't understand it.
I don't think it has the power that that Mellon asserts that it has. And moreover, I do think it's important that that Mitchell didn't sign that particular document.
Wasn't Mr. Sweeney a co-trustee?
Yes, he was.
So we have the bank and Mr. Sweeney as the trustees.
Yes.
And wasn't Mr. Sweeney their attorney?
Yes.
And he was their attorney throughout this.
He did resign at one point in time, but. When the documents were executed, I believe he was their attorney.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn. Thank you.